Did by Stanford graduate students Larry Page and Sergey Brin, just 2 years after the Mosaic browser threw open the doors of the World Wide Web to the computer-using public. From the start, the company embodied the promise of information capitalism as a liberating and democratic social force that galvanized and delighted second modernity populations around the world. Thanks to this wide embrace, Google successfully imposed computer mediation on broad new domains of human behavior as people searched online and engaged with the web through a growing roster of Google services. As these new activities were informated for the first time, they produced wholly new data resources. For example, in addition to keywords, each Google search query produces a wake of collateral data, such as the number and pattern of search terms, how a query is phrased, spelling, punctuation, dwell times, click patterns, and location. Early on, these behavioral byproducts were haphazardly stored and operationally ignored. Amit Patel, a young Stanford graduate student with a special interest in data mining, is frequently credited with the groundbreaking insight into the significance of Google's accidental data caches. His work with these data logs persuaded him that detailed stories about each user, thoughts, feelings, interests, could be constructed from the wake of unstructured signals that trailed every online action. These data, he concluded, actually provided a broad sensor of human behavior and could be put to immediate use in realizing co-founder Larry Page's dream of search as a comprehensive artificial intelligence. Google's engineers soon grasped that the continuous flow of collateral behavioral data could turn the search engine into a recursive learning system that constantly improved search results and spurred product innovations such as spell check, translation, and voice recognition. As Kenneth Cukier observed at the time, other search engines in the 1990s had the chance to do the same but did not pursue it. Around 2000, Yahoo saw the potential, but nothing came of the idea. It was Google that recognized the gold dust in the detritus of its interactions with its users and took the trouble to collect it up. Google exploits information that is a byproduct of user interactions, or data exhaust, which is automatically recycled to improve the service or create an entirely new product. What had been regarded as waste material, data exhaust spewed into Google's servers during the combustive action of search, was quickly reimagined as a critical element in the transformation of Google's search engine into a reflexive process of continuous learning and improvement. At that early stage of Google's development, the feedback loops involved in improving its search functions produced a balance of power. Search needed people to learn from, and people needed search to learn from. This symbiosis enabled Google's algorithms to learn and produce ever more relevant and comprehensive search results. More queries meant more learning. More learning produced more relevance. More relevance meant more searches and more users. By the time the young company held its first press conference in 1999, to announce a $25 million equity investment from two of the most revered Silicon Valley venture capital firms, Sequoia Capital and Kleiner Perkins, Google Search was already fielding 7 million requests each day. A few years later, Hal Varian, who joined Google as its chief economist in 2002, would note, "Every action a user performs is considered a signal to be analyzed and fed back into the system." The PageRank algorithm, named after its founder, had already given Google a significant advantage in identifying the most popular results for queries. Over the course of the next few years, it would be the capture, storage, analysis, and learning from the byproducts of those search queries that would turn Google into the gold standard of web search. The key point for us rests on a critical distinction. During this early period, behavioral data were put to work entirely on the user's behalf. User data provided value at no cost, and that value was reinvested in the user experience in the form of improved services, enhancements that were also offered at no cost to users. Users provided the raw material in the form of behavioral data, and those data were harvested to improve speed, accuracy, and relevance, and to help build ancillary products such as translation. I call this the behavioral value reinvestment cycle, in which all behavioral data are reinvested in the improvement of the product or service. The cycle emulates the logic of the iPod. It worked beautifully at Google, but with one critical difference: the absence of a sustainable market transaction. In the case of the iPod, the cycle was triggered by the purchase of a high-margin physical product. Subsequent reciprocities improved the iPod product and led to increased sales. Customers were the subjects of the commercial process, which promised alignment with their "what I want, when I want, where I want" demands. At Google, the cycle was similarly oriented toward the individual as its subject, but without a physical product to sell, it floated outside the marketplace, an interaction with users rather than a market transaction with customers. This helps to explain why it is inaccurate to think of Google's users as its customers. There is no economic exchange, no price, and no profit. Nor do users function in the role of workers. When a capitalist hires workers and provides them with wages and means of production, the products that they produce belong to the capitalist to sell at a profit. Not so here. Users are not paid for their labor, nor do they operate the means of production, as we'll discuss in more depth later in this chapter. Finally, people often say that the user is the product. This is also misleading, and it is a point that we will revisit more than once. For now, let's say that users are not products, but rather we are the sources of raw material supply. As we shall see, surveillance capitalism's unusual products manage to be derived from our behavior while remaining indifferent to our behavior. Its products are about predicting us without actually caring what we do or what is done to us. To summarize, at this early stage of Google's development, whatever search users inadvertently gave up that was of value to the company, they also used up in the form of improved services. In this reinvestment cycle, serving users with amazing search results consumed all the value that users created when they provided extra behavioral data. The fact that users needed search about as much as search needed users created a balance of power between Google and its populations. People were treated as ends in themselves, the subjects of a non-market, self-contained cycle that was perfectly aligned with Google's stated mission to organize the world's information, making it universally accessible and useful. 3. Search for capitalism. Impatient money and the state of exception. By 1999, despite the splendor of Google's new world of searchable web pages, its growing computer science capabilities, and its glamorous venture backers, there was no reliable way to turn investors' money into revenue. The behavioral value investment cycle produced a very cool search function, but it was not yet capitalism. The balance of power made it financially risky and possibly counterproductive to charge users a fee for search services. Selling search results would also have set a dangerous precedent for the firm, assigning a price to index information that Google's web crawler had already taken from others without payment. Without a device like Apple's iPod or its digital songs, there were no margins, no surplus, nothing left over to sell and turn into revenue. Google had relegated advertising to steerage class. Its AdWords team consisted of 7 people, most of whom shared the founder's general antipathy toward ads. The tone had been set in Sergey Brin and Larry Page's milestone paper that unveiled their search engine conception, The Anatomy of a Large-Scale, Hypertextual Web Search Engine, presented at the 1998 World Wide Web Conference. We expect that advertising-funded search engines will be inherently biased towards the advertisers and away from the needs of the consumers. This type of bias is very difficult to detect, but could still have a significant effect on the market. We believe the issue of advertising causes enough mixed incentives that it is crucial to have a competitive search engine that is transparent and in the academic realm. Google's first revenues depended instead on exclusive licensing deals to provide web services to portals such as Yahoo and Japan's Big Globe. It also generated modest revenue from sponsored ads linked to search query keywords. There were other models for consideration. Rival search engines such as Overture, used exclusively by the then-giant portal AOL, or Inktomi, the search engine adopted by Microsoft, collected revenues from the sites whose pages they indexed. Overture was also successful in attracting online ads with its policy of allowing advertisers to pay for high-ranking search listings, the very format that Brin and Page scorned. Prominent analysts publicly doubted whether Google could compete with its more established rivals. As the New York Times asked, "Can Google create a business model even remotely as good as its technology?" A well-known Forrester research analyst proclaimed that there were only a few ways for Google to make money with search. Build a portal like Yahoo, partner with a portal, license the technology, wait for a big company to purchase them. Despite these general misgivings about Google's viability, the firm's prestigious venture backing gave the founders confidence in their ability to raise money. This changed abruptly in April 2000, when the legendary dot-com economy began its steep plunge into recession, and Silicon Valley's Garden of Eden unexpectedly became the epicenter of a financial earthquake. By mid-April, Silicon Valley's fast-money culture of privilege was under siege with the implosion of what came to be known as the dot-com bubble. It is easy to forget exactly how terrifying things were for the Valley's ambitious young people and their slightly older investors. Startups with outsized valuations just months earlier were suddenly forced to shutter. Prominent articles such as "Doom Stalks the Dot-Coms" noted that the stock prices of Wall Street's most revered internet high flyers were down for the count, with many of them trading below their initial offering price. With many dot-coms declining, neither venture capitalists nor Wall Street is eager to give them a dime. The news brimmed with descriptions of shell-shocked investors. The week of April 10th saw the worst decline in the history of the NASDAQ, where many internet companies had gone public, and there was a growing consensus that the game had irreversibly changed. As the business environment in Silicon Valley unraveled, investors' prospects for cashing out by selling Google to a big company seemed far less likely, and they were not immune to the rising tide of panic. Many Google investors began to express doubts about the company's prospects, and some threatened to withdraw support. Pressure for profit mounted sharply, despite the fact that Google Search was widely considered the best of all the search engines. Traffic to its website was surging, and 1,000 resumes flooded the firm's Mountain View office each day. Page and Brin were seen to be moving too slowly, and their top venture capitalists, John Doerr from Kleiner Perkins and Michael Moritz from Sequoia, were frustrated. According to Google chronicler Stephen Levy, the VCs were screaming bloody murder. Tech's salad days were over, and it wasn't certain that Google would avoid becoming another crushed radish. The specific character of Silicon Valley's venture funding, especially during the years leading up to the dangerous levels of startup inflation, also contributed to a growing sense of emergency at Google. As Stanford sociologist Mark Granovetter and his colleague Michel Ferrari found in their study of Valley venture firms, a connection with a high-status VC firm signals the high status of the startup and encourages other agents to link to it. These themes may seem obvious now, but it is useful to mark the anxiety of those months of sudden crisis. Prestigious risk investment functioned as a form of vetting, much like acceptance to a top university sorts and legitimates students, elevating a few against the backdrop of the many, especially in the uncertain environment characteristic of high-tech investing. Loss of that high-status signaling power assigned a young company to a long list of also-rans in Silicon Valley's fast-moving saga. Other research findings point to the consequences of the impatient money that flooded the valley as inflationary hype drew speculators and ratcheted up the volatility of venture funding. Studies of pre-bubble investment patterns showed a big score mentality in which bad results tended to stimulate increased investing as funders chased the belief that some young company would suddenly discover the elusive business model destined to turn all their bets into rivers of gold. Startup mortality rates in Silicon Valley outstripped those for other venture capital centers such as Boston and Washington, D.C., with impatient money producing a few big wins and many losses. Impatient money is also reflected in the size of Silicon Valley startups, which during this period were significantly smaller than in other regions, employing an average of 68 employees as compared to an average of 112 in the rest of the country. This reflects an interest in quick returns without spending much time on growing a business or deepening its talent base, let alone developing the institutional capabilities that Joseph Schumpeter would have advised. These propensities were exacerbated by the larger Silicon Valley culture, where net worth was celebrated as the sole measure of success for Valley parents and their children. For all their genius and principled insights, Brin and Page could not ignore the mounting sense of emergency. By December 2000, The Wall Street Journal reported on the new mantra emerging from Silicon Valley's investment community. Simply displaying the ability to make money will not be enough to remain a major player in the years ahead. What will be required will be an ability to show sustained and exponential profits.
4. The discovery of behavioral surplus. The declaration of a state of exception functions in politics as cover for the suspension of the rule of law and the introduction of new executive powers justified by crisis. At Google in late 2000, it became a rationale for annulling the reciprocal relationship that existed between Google and its users, steeling the founders to abandon their passionate and public opposition to advertising. As a specific response to investors' anxiety, the founders tasked the tiny AdWords team with the objective of looking for ways to make more money. Page demanded that the whole process be simplified for advertisers. In this new approach, he insisted that advertisers shouldn't even get involved with choosing keywords. Google would choose them. Operationally, this meant that Google would turn its own growing cache of behavioral data and its computational power and expertise toward the single task of matching ads with queries. New rhetoric took hold to legitimate this unusual move. If there was to be advertising, then it had to be relevant to users. Ads would no longer be linked to keywords in a search query, but rather a particular ad would be targeted to a particular individual. Securing this holy grail of advertising would ensure relevance to users and value to advertisers. Absent from the new rhetoric was the fact that in pursuit of this new aim, Google would cross into virgin territory by exploiting sensitivities that only its exclusive and detailed collateral behavioral data about millions and later billions of users could reveal. To meet the new objective, the behavioral value reinvestment cycle was rapidly and secretly subordinated to a larger and more complex undertaking. The raw materials that had been solely used to improve the quality of search results would now also be put to use in the service of targeting advertising to individual users. Some data would continue to be applied to service improvement, but the growing stores of collateral signals would be repurposed to improve the profitability of ads for both Google and its advertisers. These behavioral data available for uses beyond service improvement constituted a surplus, and it was on the strength of this behavioral surplus that the young company would find its way to the sustained and exponential profits that would be necessary for survival. Thanks to a perceived emergency, a new mutation began to gather form and quietly slip its moorings in the implicit advocacy-oriented social contract of the firm's original relationship with users. Google's declared state of exception was the backdrop for 2002, the watershed year during which surveillance capitalism took root. The firm's appreciation of behavioral surplus crossed another threshold that April when the data logs team arrived at their offices one morning to find that a peculiar phrase had surged to the top of the search queries. Carol Brady's maiden name. Why the sudden interest in a 1970s television character? It was data scientist and logs team member Amit Patel who recounted the event to the New York Times, noting, "You can't interpret it unless you know what else is going on in the world." The team went to work to solve the puzzle. First, they discerned that the pattern of queries had produced 5 separate spikes, each beginning at 48 minutes after the hour. Then they learned that the query pattern occurred during the airing of the popular TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The spikes reflected the successive time zones during which the show aired, ending in Hawaii. In each time zone, the show's host posed the question of Carol Brady's maiden name, and in each zone, the queries immediately flooded into Google's servers. As the New York Times reported, the precision of the Carol Brady data was eye-opening for some. Even Brin was stunned by the clarity of search's predictive power, revealing events and trends before they hit the radar of traditional media. As he told the Times, it was like trying an electron microscope for the first time. It was like a moment-by-moment barometer. Google executives were described by the Times as reluctant to share their thoughts about how their massive stores of query data might be commercialized. "There is tremendous opportunity with this data," one executive confided. Just a month before the Carol Brady moment, while the AdWords team was already working on new approaches, Brin and Page hired Eric Schmidt, an experienced executive, engineer, and computer science PhD, as chairman. By August, they appointed him to the CEO's role. Dorr and Moritz had been pushing the founders to hire a professional manager who would know how to pivot the firm toward profit. Schmidt immediately implemented a belt-tightening program, grabbing the budgetary reins and heightening the general sense of financial alarm as fundraising prospects came under threat. A squeeze on workplace found him unexpectedly sharing his office with none other than Amit Patel. Schmidt later boasted that as a result of their close quarters over the course of several months, he had instant access to better revenue figures than did his own financial planners. We do not know and may never know what other insights Schmidt might have gleaned from Patel about the predictive power of Google's behavioral data stores, but there is no doubt that a deeper grasp of the predictive power of data quickly shaped Google's specific response to financial emergency, triggering the crucial mutation that ultimately turned AdWords, Google, the Internet, and the very nature of information capitalism toward an astonishingly lucrative surveillance project. Google's earliest ads had been considered more effective than most online advertising at the time because they were linked to search queries, and Google could track when users actually clicked on an ad, known as the click-through rate. Despite this, advertisers were billed in the conventional manner according to how many people viewed an ad. As search expanded, Google created the self-service system called AdWords, in which a search that used the advertiser's keyword would include that advertiser's text box and a link to its landing page. Ad pricing depended upon the ad's position on the search results page. Rival search startup Overture had developed an online auction system for web page placement that allowed it to scale online advertising targeted to keywords. Google would produce a transformational enhancement to that model, one that was destined to alter the course of information capitalism. As a Bloomberg journalist explained in 2006, Google maximizes the revenue it gets from that precious real estate by giving its best position to the advertiser who is likely to pay Google the most in total, based on the price per click multiplied by Google's estimate of the likelihood that someone will actually click on the ad. That pivotal multiplier was the result of Google's advanced computational capabilities, trained on its most significant and secret discovery, behavioral surplus. From this point forward, the combination of ever-increasing machine intelligence and ever more vast supplies of behavioral surplus would become the foundation of an unprecedented logic of accumulation. Google's reinvestment priorities would shift from merely improving its user offerings to inventing and institutionalizing the most far-reaching and technologically advanced raw material supply operations that the world had ever seen. Henceforth, revenues and growth would depend upon more behavioral surplus. Google's many patents filed during those early years illustrate the explosion of discovery, inventiveness, and complexity detonated by the state of exception that led to these crucial innovations, and the firm's determination to advance the capture of behavioral surplus. Among these efforts, I focus here on one patent submitted in 2003 by three of the firm's top computer scientists, entitled Generating User Information for Use in Targeted Advertising. The patent is emblematic of the new mutation and the emerging logic of accumulation that would define Google's success. Of even greater interest, it also provides an unusual glimpse into the economic orientation baked deep into the technology cake by reflecting the mindset of Google's distinguished scientists as they harnessed their knowledge to the firm's new aims. In this way, the patent stands as a treatise on a new political economics of clicks and its moral universe before the company learned to disguise this project in a fog of euphemism. The patent reveals a pivoting of the backstage operation toward Google's new audience of genuine customers. The present invention concerns advertising, the inventors announce. Despite the enormous quantity of demographic data available to advertisers, the scientists note that much of an ad budget is simply wasted. It is very difficult to identify and eliminate such waste. Advertising had always been a guessing game. Art, relationships, conventional wisdom, standard practice, but never science. The idea of being able to deliver a particular message to a particular person at just the moment when it might have a high probability of actually influencing his or her behavior was, and had always been, the holy grail of advertising. The inventors point out that online ad systems had also failed to achieve this elusive goal. The then-predominant approaches used by Google's competitors, in which ads were targeted to keywords or content, were unable to identify relevant ads for a particular user. Now the inventors offered a scientific solution that exceeded the most ambitious dreams of any advertising executive. There is a need to increase the relevancy of ads served for some user request, such as a search query or a document request, to the user that submitted the request. The present invention may involve novel methods, apparatus, message formats, and/or data structures for determining user profile information, and using such determined user profile information for ad serving. In other words, Google would no longer mine behavioral data strictly to improve service for users, but rather to read users' minds for the purposes of matching ads to their interests, as those interests are deducted from the collateral traces of online behavior. With Google's unique access to behavioral data, it would now be possible to know what a particular individual in a particular time and place was thinking, feeling, and doing. That this no longer seems astonishing to us, or perhaps even worthy of note, is evidence of the profound psychic numbing that has inured us to a bold and unprecedented shift in capitalist methods. The techniques described in the patent meant that each time a user queries Google's search engine, the system simultaneously presents a specific configuration of a particular ad, all in the fraction of a moment that it takes to fulfill the search query. The data used to perform this instant translation from query to ad, a predictive analysis that was dubbed matching, went far beyond the mere denotation of search terms. New data sets were compiled that would dramatically enhance the accuracy of these predictions. These data sets were referred to as user profile information, or UPI. These new data meant that there would be no more guesswork and far less waste in the advertising budget. Mathematical certainty would replace all of that. Where would UPI come from? the scientists announce a breakthrough. They first explain that some of the new data can be culled from the firm's existing systems with its continuously accruing caches of behavioral data from search. Then they stress that even more behavioral data can be hunted and herded from anywhere in the online world. UPI, they write, may be inferred, presumed, and deduced. Their new methods and computational tools could create UPI from integrating and analyzing a user's search patterns, document inquiries, and myriad other signals of online behaviors, even when users do not directly provide that personal information. User profile information may include any information about an individual user or a group of users. Such information may be provided by the user, provided by a third party authorized to release user information, and or derived from user actions. Certain user information can be deduced or presumed using other user information of the same user and or user information of other users. UPI may be associated with various entities. The inventors explain that UPI can be deduced directly from a user's or group's actions, from any kind of document a user views, and from an ad landing page. For example, an ad for prostate cancer screening might be limited to user profiles having the attribute male and age 45 and over. They describe different ways to obtain UPI. One relies on machine learning classifiers that predict values on a range of attributes. Association graphs are developed to reveal the relationships among users, documents, search queries, and web pages. User-to-user associations may also be generated. The inventors also note that their methods can be understood only among the priesthood of computer scientists drawn to the analytic challenges of this new online universe. The following description is presented to enable one skilled in the art to make and use the invention. Various modifications to the disclosed embodiments will be apparent to those skilled in the art. Of critical importance to our story is the scientists' observation that the most challenging sources of friction here are social, not technical. Friction arises when users intentionally fail to provide information for no other reason than that they choose not to. Unfortunately, user profile information is not always available, the scientists warn. Users do not always voluntarily provide information, or the user profile may be incomplete and hence not comprehensive because of privacy considerations, etc. A clear aim of the patent is to assure its audience that Google scientists will not be deterred by users' exercise of decision rights over their personal information, despite the fact that such rights were an inherent feature of the original social contract between the company and its users. Even when users do provide UPI, the inventors caution, it may be intentionally or unintentionally inaccurate. It may become stale. UPI for a user can be determined or updated or extended even when no explicit information is given to the system. An initial UPI may include some expressly entered UPI information, though it doesn't need to. The scientists thus make clear that they are willing and that their inventions are able to overcome the friction entailed in users' decision rights. Google's proprietary methods enable it to surveil, capture, expand, construct, and claim behavioral surplus, including data that users intentionally choose not to share. Recalcitrant users will not be obstacles to data expropriation. No moral, legal, or social constraints will stand in the way of finding, claiming, and analyzing others' behavior for commercial purposes. The inventors provide examples of the kinds of attributes that Google could assess as it compiles its UPI datasets while circumnavigating users' knowledge, intentions, and consent. These include websites visited, psychographics, browsing activity, and information about the previous advertisements that the user has been shown, selected, and/or made purchases after viewing. It is a long list that is certainly much longer today. Finally, the inventors observe another obstacle to effective targeting. Even when user information exists, they say, advertisers may not be able to use this information to target ads effectively. On the strength of the invention presented in this patent and others related to it, the inventors publicly declare Google's unique prowess in hunting, capturing, and transforming surplus into predictions for accurate targeting. No other firm could equal its range of access to behavioral surplus, its bench strength of scientific knowledge and technique, its computational power, or its storage infrastructure. In 2003, only Google could pull surplus from multiple sites of activity and integrate each increment of data into comprehensive data structures. Google was uniquely positioned with the state-of-the-art knowledge in computer science to convert those data into predictions of who will click on which configuration of what ad as the basis for a final matching result, all computed in microfractions of a second. To state all this in plain language, Google's invention revealed new capabilities to infer and deduce the thoughts, feelings, intentions, and interests of individuals and groups with an automated architecture that operates as a one-way mirror irrespective of a person's awareness, knowledge, and consent, thus enabling privileged secret access to behavioral data. A one-way mirror embodies the specific social relations of surveillance based on asymmetries of knowledge and power. The new mode of accumulation invented at Google would derive, above all, from the firm's willingness and ability to impose these social relations on its users. Its willingness was mobilized by what the founders came to regard as a state of exception. Its ability came from its actual success in leveraging privileged access to behavioral surplus in order to predict the behavior of individuals now, soon, and later. The predictive insights thus acquired would constitute a world-historic competitive advantage in a new marketplace where low-risk bets about the behavior of individuals are valued, bought, and sold. Google would no longer be a passive recipient of accidental data that it could recycle for the benefit of its users. The targeted advertising patent sheds light on the path of discovery that Google traveled from its advocacy-oriented founding toward the elaboration of behavioral surveillance as a full-blown logic of accumulation. The invention itself exposes the reasoning through which the behavioral value reinvestment cycle was subjugated to the service of a new commercial calculation. Behavioral data, whose value had previously been used up on improving the quality of search for users, now became the pivotal and exclusive to Google raw material for the construction of a dynamic online advertising marketplace. Google would now secure more behavioral data than it needed to serve its users. That surplus, a behavioral surplus, was the game-changing, zero-cost asset that was diverted from service improvement toward a genuine and highly lucrative market exchange. These capabilities were and remain inscrutable to all but an exclusive data priesthood among whom Google is the Ubermensch. They operate in obscurity, indifferent to social norms or individual claims to self-determining decision rights. These moves established the foundational mechanisms of surveillance capitalism. The state of exception declared by Google's founders transformed the youthful Dr. Jekyll into a ruthless, muscular Mr. Hyde, determined to hunt his prey anywhere, anytime, irrespective of others' self-determining aims. The new Google ignored claims to self-determination and acknowledged no a priori limits on what it could find and take. It dismissed the moral and legal content of individual decision rights and recast the situation as one of technological opportunism and unilateral power. This new Google assured its actual customers that it will do whatever it takes to transform the natural obscurity of human desire into scientific fact. This Google is the superpower that establishes its own values and pursues its own purposes above and beyond the social contracts to which others are bound. 5. Surplus at scale. There were other new elements that helped to establish the centrality of behavioral surplus in Google's commercial operations, beginning with its pricing innovations. The first new pricing metric was based on click-through rates, or how many times a user clicks on an ad through to the advertiser's web page, rather than pricing based on the number of views that an ad receives. The click-through was interpreted as a signal of relevance, and therefore a measure of successful targeting, operational results that derive from and reflect the value of behavioral surplus. This new pricing discipline established an ever-escalating incentive to increase behavioral surplus in order to continuously upgrade the effectiveness of predictions. Better predictions lead directly to more click-throughs and thus to revenue. Google learned new ways to conduct automated auctions for ad targeting that allowed the new information to scale quickly, accommodating hundreds of thousands of advertisers and billions, later it would be trillions, of auctions simultaneously. Google's unique auction methods and capabilities earned a great deal of attention, which distracted observers from reflecting on exactly what was being auctioned. Derivatives of behavioral surplus. Click-through metrics institutionalized customer demand for these prediction products and thus established the central importance of economies of scale in surplus supply operations. Surplus capture would have to become automatic and ubiquitous if the new logic was to succeed, as measured by the successful trading of behavioral futures. Another key metric called the quality score helped determine the price of an ad and its specific position on the page, in addition to advertisers' own auction bids. The quality score was determined in part by click-through rates and in part by the firm's analyses of behavioral surplus. The click-through rate needed to be a predictive thing, one top executive insisted, and that would require all the information we had about the query right then. It would take enormous computing power and leading-edge algorithmic programs to produce powerful predictions of user behavior that became the criteria for estimating the relevance of an ad. Ads that scored high would sell at a lower price than those that scored poorly. Google's customers, its advertisers, complained that the quality score was a black box, and Google was determined to keep it so. Nonetheless, when customers followed its disciplines and produced high-scoring ads, their click-through rates soared. AdWords quickly became so successful that it inspired significant expansion of the surveillance logic. Advertisers demanded more clicks. The answer was to extend the model beyond Google search pages and convert the entire internet into a canvas for Google's targeted ads. This required turning Google's newfound skills at data extraction and analysis, as Hal Varian put it, toward the content of any web page or user action by employing Google's rapidly expanding semantic analysis and artificial intelligence capabilities to efficiently squeeze meaning from them. Only then could Google accurately assess the content of a page and how users interact with that content. This content-targeted advertising, based on Google's patented method, was eventually named AdSense. By 2004, AdSense had achieved a run rate of $1 million per day. And by 2010, it produced annual revenues of more than $10 billion. So here was an unprecedented and lucrative brew. Behavioral surplus, data science, material infrastructure, computational power, algorithmic systems, and automated platforms. This convergence produced unprecedented relevance and billions of auctions. Click-through rates skyrocketed. Work on AdWords and AdSense became just as important as work on search. With click-through rates as the measure of relevance accomplished, behavioral surplus was institutionalized as the cornerstone of a new kind of commerce that depended upon online surveillance at scale. Insiders referred to Google's new science of behavioral prediction as the physics of clicks. Mastery of this new domain required a specialized breed of click physicists who would secure Google's preeminence within the nascent priesthood of behavioral prediction. The firm's substantial revenue flows summoned the greatest minds of our age from fields such as artificial intelligence, statistics, machine learning, data science, and predictive analytics to converge on the prediction of human behavior as measured by click-through rates. Computer-mediated fortune-telling and selling. The firm would recruit an authority on information economics and consultant to Google since 2001 as the patriarch of this auspicious group and the still young science. Hal Varian was the chosen shepherd of this flock. Page and Brin had been reluctant to embrace advertising, but as the evidence mounted that ads could save the company from crisis, their attitude shifted. Saving the company also meant saving themselves from being just another couple of very smart guys who couldn't figure out how to make real money, insignificant players in the intensely material and competitive culture of Silicon Valley. Page was haunted by the example of the brilliant but impoverished scientist Nikola Tesla, who died without ever benefiting financially from his inventions. "You need to do more than just invent things," Page reflected. Brin had his own take. "Honestly, when we were still in the dot-com boom days, I felt like a schmuck. I had an internet startup, so did everybody else. It was unprofitable, like everybody else's." Exceptional threats to their financial and social status appear to have awakened a survival instinct in Page and Brin that required exceptional adaptive measures. The Google founder's response to the fear that stalked their community effectively declared a state of exception, in which it was judged necessary to suspend the values and principles that had guided Google's founding and early practices. Later, Sequoia's Moritz recalled the crisis conditions that provoked the firm's ingenious self-reinvention, when crisis opened a fork in the road and drew the company in a wholly new direction. He stressed the specificity of Google's inventions, their origins in emergency, and the 180-degree turn from serving users to surveilling them. Most of all, he credited the discovery of behavioral surplus as the game-changing asset that turned Google into a fortune-telling giant, pinpointing Google's breakthrough transformation of the overture model when the young company first applied its analytics of behavioral surplus to predict the likelihood of a click. Moritz said, "The first 12 months of Google were not a cakewalk, because the company didn't start off in the business that it eventually tapped. At first it went in a different direction, which was selling its technology, selling licenses for its search engines to larger internet properties and to corporations. Cash was going out of the window at a feral rate during the first 6-7 months. And then, very ingeniously, Larry and Sergey and others fastened on a model that they had seen this other company, Overture, develop, which was ranked advertisements. They saw how it could be improved and enhanced and made it their own, and that transformed the business." Moritz's reflections suggest that without the discovery of behavioral surplus and the turn toward surveillance operations, Google's feral rate of spending was not sustainable, and the firm's survival was imperiled. We will never know what Google might have made of itself without the state of exception fueled by the emergency of impatient money that shaped those crucial years of development. What other pathways to sustainable revenue might have been explored or invented? What alternative futures might have been summoned to keep faith with the founders' principles and with their users' right to self-determination? Instead, Google loosed a new incarnation of capitalism upon the world, a Pandora's box whose contents we are only beginning to understand. 6. A human invention. Key to our conversation is this fact. Surveillance capitalism was invented by a specific group of human beings in a specific time and place. It is not an inherent result of digital technology, nor is it a necessary expression of information capitalism. It was intentionally constructed at a moment in history in much the same way that the engineers and tinkerers at the Ford Motor Company invented mass production in the Detroit of 1913. Henry Ford set out to prove that he could maximize profits by driving up volumes, radically decreasing costs, and widening demand. It was an unproven commercial equation for which no economic theory or body of practice existed. Fragments of the formula had surfaced before, in meatpacking plants, flour milling operations, sewing machine and bicycle factories, armories, canneries, and breweries. There was a growing body of practical knowledge about the interchangeability of parts and absolute standardization, precision machines, and continuous flow production. But no one had achieved the grand symphony that Ford heard in his imagination. As historian David Hounshell tells it, there was a time, April 1, 1913, and a place, Detroit, when the first moving assembly line seemed to be just another step in the years of development at Ford, yet somehow suddenly dropped out of the sky. Even before the end of the day, some of the engineers sensed that they had made a fundamental breakthrough. Within a year, productivity increases across the plant ranged from 50% to as much as 10 times the output of the old fixed assembly methods. The Model T, that sold for $825 in 1908, was priced at a record low for a four-cylinder automobile in 1924, just $260. Much as with Ford, some elements of the economic surveillance logic in the online environment had been operational for years, familiar only to a rarefied group of early computer experts. For example, the software mechanism known as the cookie, bits of code that allow information to be passed between a server and a client computer, was developed in 1994 at Netscape, the first commercial web browser company. Similarly, web bugs, tiny, often invisible graphics embedded in web pages and email and designed to monitor user activity and collect personal information, were well known to experts in the late 1990s. These experts were deeply concerned about the privacy implications of such monitoring mechanisms, and at least in the case of cookies, there were institutional efforts to design internet policies that would prohibit their invasive capabilities to monitor and profile users. By 1996, the function of cookies had become a contested public policy issue. Federal Trade Commission workshops in 1996 and 1997 discussed proposals that would assign control of all personal information to users by default with a simple automated protocol. Advertisers bitterly contested this scheme, collaborating instead to avert government regulation by forming a self-regulating association known as the Network Advertising Initiative. Still, in June 2000, the Clinton administration banned cookies from all federal websites, and by April 2001, three bills before Congress included provisions to regulate cookies. Google brought new life to these practices. As had occurred at Ford a century earlier, the company's engineers and scientists were the first to conduct the entire commercial surveillance symphony, integrating a wide range of mechanisms from cookies to proprietary analytics and algorithmic software capabilities in a sweeping new logic that enshrined surveillance and the unilateral expropriation of behavioral data as the basis for a new market form. The impact of this invention was just as dramatic as Ford's. In 2001, as Google's new systems to exploit its discovery of behavioral surplus were being tested, net revenues jumped to $86 million, more than a 400% increase over 2000, and the company turned its first profit. By 2002, the cash began to flow and has never stopped. Definitive evidence that behavioral surplus, combined with Google's proprietary analytics, were sending arrows to their marks. Revenues leapt to $347 million in 2002, then $1.5 billion in 2003, and $3.5 billion in 2004, the year the company went public. The discovery of behavioral surplus had produced a stunning 3,590% increase in revenue in less than 4 years. 7. The Secrets of Extraction. It is important to note the vital differences for capitalism in these two moments of originality at Ford and Google. Ford's inventions revolutionized production. Google's inventions revolutionized extraction and established surveillance capitalism's first economic imperative, the extraction imperative. The extraction imperative meant that raw material supplies must be procured at an ever-expanding scale. Industrial capitalism had demanded economies of scale in production in order to achieve high throughput combined with low unit cost. In contrast, surveillance capitalism demands economies of scale in the extraction of behavioral surplus. Mass production was aimed at new sources of demand in the early 20th century's first mass consumers. Ford was clear on this point. Mass production begins in the perception of a public need. Supply and demand were linked effects of the new conditions of existence that defined the lives of my great-grandparents, Sophie and Max, and other travelers in the first modernity. Ford's invention deepened the reciprocities between capitalism and these populations. In contrast, Google's inventions destroyed the reciprocities of its original social contract with users. The role of the behavioral value reinvestment cycle that had once aligned Google with its users changed dramatically. Instead of deepening the unity of supply and demand with its populations, Google chose to reinvent its business around the burgeoning demand of advertisers, eager to squeeze and scrape online behavior by any available means in the competition for market advantage. In the new operation, users were no longer ends in themselves, but rather became the means to others' ends. Reinvestment in user services became the method for attracting behavioral surplus, and users became the unwitting suppliers of raw material for a larger cycle of revenue generation. The scale of surplus expropriation that was possible at Google would soon eliminate all serious competitors to its core search business, as the windfall earnings from leveraging behavioral surplus were used to continuously draw more users into its net, thus establishing its de facto monopoly in search. On the strength of Google's inventions, discoveries, and strategies, it became the mothership and ideal type of a new economic logic based on fortune-telling and selling, an ancient and eternally lucrative craft that has fed on humanity's confrontation with uncertainty from the beginning of the human story. It was one thing to proselytize achievements in production, as Henry Ford had done, but quite another to boast about the continuous intensification of hidden processes aimed at the extraction of behavioral data and personal information. The last thing that Google wanted was to reveal the secrets of how it had rewritten its own rules, and in the process, enslaved itself to the extraction imperative. Behavioral surplus was necessary for revenue, and secrecy would be necessary for the sustained accumulation of behavioral surplus. This is how secrecy came to be institutionalized in the policies and practices that govern every aspect of Google's behavior on stage and off stage. Once Google's leadership understood the commercial power of behavioral surplus, Schmidt instituted what he called the hiding strategy. Google employees were told not to speak about what the patent had referred to as its novel methods, apparatus, message formats, and/or data structures, or confirm any rumors about flowing cash. Hiding was not a post hoc strategy. It was baked into the cake that would become surveillance capitalism. Former Google executive Douglas Edwards writes compellingly about this predicament and the culture of secrecy it shaped. According to his account, Page and Brin were hawks, insisting on aggressive data capture and retention. Larry opposed any path that would reveal our technological secrets or stir the privacy pot and endanger our ability to gather data. Page wanted to avoid arousing users' curiosity by minimizing their exposure to any clues about the reach of the firm's data operations. He questioned the prudence of the electronic scroll in the reception lobby that displays a continuous stream of search queries, and he tried to kill the annual Google Zeitgeist conference that summarizes the year's trends in search terms. Journalist John Battelle, who chronicled Google during the 2002 to 2004 period, described the company's aloofness, limited information sharing, and alienating and unnecessary secrecy and isolation. Another early company biographer notes, "What made this information easier to keep is that almost none of the experts tracking the business of the Internet believed that Google's secret was even possible." As Schmidt told the New York Times, "You need to win, but you are better off